Hey everyone, it's your host here, Jake Hirschman. Excited for you to dive into these highlight episodes, whether you're a longtime listener or first-time listener. These are going to be shortened episodes from the past that bring you the best of the best of the content from great guests. Enjoy these and want to take a quick moment to thank our two sponsors, Suju Organic and Screen Skins. Get your 15% off Suju Organic at sujuorganic.com with the code LIFO, L-I-F-O, and visit screenskins.com for 20% off at checkout with the code LIFO24. Get your screen protector today. Thanks. Enjoy the episode. This is the Life in the Front Office Plus, where we dive deeper into personal and professional development, share nuggets and highlights from previous episodes, and bring you new content to provide insights and perspectives beyond the front office. Enjoy today's episode.
You know, you are, and I always give Jake these terms, and he shrugs his shoulders. So I said, so Ben Sutton is II. And they go, oh, was he in the Navy? I go, my II is institutionally inquisitive. He always wants to know what's happening. How does that work? Where is it going? So if you look at the business of collegiate sports today, and if you could give the listeners just a bit of background on how you started down the road from Tobacco Road and the Carolinas and Wake, and you built these institutions, which you continue to build, what was it like back then? What did you see, and what do you see now?
I would say first, Andy, that, you know, universities are a little bit like, government. They're not exactly known for being nimble. They're not exactly known for being bastions of excellence when it comes to innovation. Certainly there are areas where that is the case, but they're not generally, places that foster the entrepreneurial spirit. And so I would say that my learning of working at Wake Forest while I was in law school, really in a full-time job, and then continuing after law school for another 7.5 or 8 years, was that if you wanted to build a nimble organization, you needed to have the business components that make up that organization out of a place that was by definition not going to be nimble. And so I watched and looked and I studied the pros, because they generally have always kind of been, especially the NFL, it kind of been 20 or 25 years ahead of, amateur sports in terms of the way they market.
And a lot of the other pro sports that are
all the pro sports were ahead of, all the big leagues were ahead of college. And you looked and they all had all their rights kind of, in one package. And in college, for whatever reason, my study analysis was actually on the University of North Carolina, not Wake Forest. I was like, how can North Carolina have one company selling their live radio play-by-play, another company selling their television coaches shows, and maybe at that point they maybe had some third tier television rights, and another company selling their call-in shows, and another company selling their out-of-home signage, etc., and another company selling their print publishing stuff. And at that point in the 1990s, Al Gore hadn't invented the internet yet, and so the digital assets didn't exist, but you had, Carolina literally had 7 different vendors in the marketplace representing the University of North Carolina. Now, these billionaire owners of the National Football League and Major League Baseball, most of them, some of them did wake up on third base thinking they hit a triple and daddy passed down the money from granddaddy and they got it. But most of them actually made their own money. They're pretty smart guys. And so they would never stand for a model like that. They built other organizations and, where all the sales for the organization were in the organization. And so basically all I did was co-opt that model and put it in college sports. And for whatever reason, my competitors, all of whom I have great healthy respect for, but Learfield hosts, CBS, ESPN, they were kind of one dimensional. And I thought, well, gosh, if we put all the objects together in one basket and take it to market, the school is going to be the largest beneficiary, but we're going to benefit too as their rights holder. And so it took a few years for schools to lose that model because, again, they're not nimble. They don't move fast.
Well, they have more constituencies that have a decision in the pie than any of the pros, right?
Correct. And so instead of one person, you got a committee for everything. And so, but we convinced Wake Forest to do it and showed them why it was compelling for Wake. And we rapidly got adoption from Virginia Tech and Cincinnati and Marshall and Alabama and Georgia Tech, and we were off to the races. And so over the course of 18 years, you know, we went from being somebody nobody had ever heard of in 1992 to the point that by 2007-8, 15 years into the deal, you know, we were not only the market maker, we were the market leader. So lots of people have said this, and lots of people will take credit for inventing the saying, but culture eats strategy for lunch. And I really do believe that if you don't get your culture right, that it makes building a sustainable organization, a company that is, as Jerry Porras and Jim Collins described in their treatise, Built to Last, you don't have a chance to build companies to last. And in fact, they devote an entire chapter in the book to kind of cult-like cultures and pruning people off of the tree that don't belong there. And I do think that is really important. And so getting, you know, and I don't mean a coddling culture. I mean one where you're very selective in your recruitment and identification of talent. And then once you have them, you empower them, but you also give them tools. And as you know, we were, and I continue to be a huge proponent of training and development. And I like to always know that we have the right people on the bus and that every dollar we invest is an investment and not just an expenditure. And so having, you know, having a great recruitment effort and then being able to train and develop to create that trust, to create a team, to have a culture where people can see a way and a path forward to where they can go to higher leadership positions in the company. All of those things matter. Now, I've studied and I've been around and talked to lots of different people in my career about building culture. Frankly, as I said to some folks just a few years ago, you know, anybody can build a culture when all of your employees are in one office in Los Angeles or two offices in Los Angeles and somewhere else or New York and Nashville. You know, you can fall off a turnip truck and build, as we would say in Eastern North Carolina, and build a culture when everybody's in the same building. When you know that you have the secret sauce right, is when you can have 100 or 200 offices. In our case, we had 105 offices in 42 different states with 1,000 different employees, and the culture was the same, same positive, teamwork-oriented, leadership-building, trusting, confident culture. Yeah, I was so privileged at the end of his life to know Coach John Wooden. Coaches love reps and they love practice. There you go. I've probably given out 500, maybe 1,000 copies of his book called My Personal Best. But here's the thing, Jake, that's a great question. So I would say, first of all, you know, kind of knowing your limitations. And one of mine is that I am not a morning person. I'm a night owl. And another is that I have people pulling at me all the time, like literally on a daily basis. It's not less than tens, and there have been times when it could probably, you know, tip at 100 in a day trying to get at me. I followed kind of three strict rules my whole career, still do it. Number one, have a great gatekeeper who won't suffer fools gladly or let your calendar become a mess. I frankly have went through a lot of assistance in my career because I needed somebody who was really, the left tackle. I was trying to remember the name of that movie with Sandra Bullock.
But Blindside.
Blindside.
They always have your blindside. Secondly, I will do my to-do list right after I leave this podcast. I'm going to go home. I'll do my to-do list today for tomorrow. Because I find that it's just helpful. It also lets me congratulate myself to look at today's list and kind of pat myself on the back and say, boy, you really did have a really productive day. But the third thing, and I heard this, I can't remember when who or from whom I heard this. I think it was like Zig Ziglar or something. But
the world's greatest salesman, yes.
World's greatest salesman. Unlock the rest of your day by doing the most disagreeable thing first thing in the morning. So if you have to fire somebody, do it first thing. If you have a huge project you need to finish, dive into it. If you've got to negotiate the finer and most difficult points of a contract, do it first thing in the morning. Who wants to have a black cloud over their head the whole day, knowing that they've got the really hard thing coming out? And I've just found that emotionally and just in my mind, it just opens up the entire day to get any of the hard stuff out of the way first thing. So that's what I do. You know, I would say so as a foundational premise, I think that people, God put us all on earth to do one thing, and that was to pursue joy. So I taught my kids that all they've heard from me their whole life, all of my teammates my whole life. There's never been a teammate I had that didn't hear this from me. Few things in life inspire joy, pursue only those. If you're not in love with what you do, if you're not in love with the people that you work with, then it's time to find something else to do. If you get that right, then everything else is kind of easy. So for me, kind of the next steps were identifying, as I said, great talent, getting the right people on the bus, but in the right places on the bus. And so the number of times that I repurposed someone because they were just sitting in the wrong seat. I knew they had talent, but it's kind of like, a general manager trying to, or a manager of a baseball team saying, I'm going to get so much more out of this person if I take the pressure off of him and take him out of the number one leadoff spot and put him number seven in the lineup. Their batting average is going to go up 20 points. And so I think that's really important. And I've only ever wanted people around me who were insufferable losers. I want them to be just like me. They hate to lose. Therefore, they learn from their mistakes. They get better. They aspire to win. At ISP, at IMG, and now at Teal Capital and our three portfolio businesses, TPG, our high school sports business, Revel, our game day experiential business, and Die Hard, our e-commerce retail business. Our batting average in business development is about 750. That'll get you in every Hall of Fame in the country. And I believe it's because our team, we have the right people, we have them in the right places. We're constantly training and retraining, trying to bring out all their potential. They're in a place where I think they hopefully feel appreciated and they feel like, that they're not just happy, but they're literally just full of joy. I go back, as I said to Andy a moment ago, when you look at our leadership team and see that 75% of the leadership team in our newest ventures are all people who worked with me in our older ventures at ISP and IMG, I think that speaks, volumes to, being pretty good at recruiting great talent, building culture, keeping people together, helping them realize their potential, building wealth. All of those things matter.
Thanks for listening to today's episode on the Life in the Front Office Plus. And remember to share with a friend or colleague, leave a review, and tune in to each weekly or monthly episode across our shows.